it's Diane. Great to be with you for a special Tuesday edition of On My Mind. My guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. She's written best-selling biographies of Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Lyndon B. Johnson. Her latest book examines what made each of these four presidents effective leaders during particularly difficult moments in our country's history. It's called Leadership in Turbulent Times. Though she started writing the book 5 years ago, Kearns Goodwin says the lessons she learned about leadership feel particularly relevant for today's polarized political climate. Doris, how great to talk with you again.
I feel like we've been doing this for a long time, and I'm very honored to be doing it again.
Doris, let's talk about your newest book, Leadership in Turbulent Times. You've chosen four leaders. Tell me about the ones you chose and why.
Well, I chose Abraham Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson in domestic politics, in part because these are the leaders I was closest to. And I realized that when I finish each leadership book, I have to put the past president behind, and I feel sort of guilty when I get a new president like I've left an old boyfriend behind. So this time I decided, what if I go back to those four people and look at how they led during their own turbulent times? Because we feel like we're living in such a turbulent time now, but when you think about what LBJ faced with the assassination of JFK and the worry about a conspiracy that was happening and the civil rights movement stuck and lots of violence in the air, or think of Franklin Roosevelt with the Depression at its height when he came into office, Teddy Roosevelt when the Industrial Revolution had shaken up the economy more than the tech revolution has today, or, of course, Lincoln coming in when the country is split in two. And yet they all, because of the leaders that were there and because of the citizens in their own activities, were able to come through those struggles stronger and more unified than before. And I think just in our time right now, and there's such a sense of lost moorings and anxiety about the future of the country, it turns out the book is more relevant now than it was 5 years ago when I started to do this.
I gather that the inspiration for this book actually came from a student.
That is true. What happened is I've been thinking about doing something on leadership because I've been lecturing on leadership for the last 20 years, really. But it would always be like leadership lessons from Franklin Roosevelt after I finished him, or Teddy Roosevelt, or Lincoln. And a student said to me in one of those lectures, but how can I ever imagine that I will become one of those leaders? It's too far away. They're too remote. They're on, you know, Mount Rushmore. They're in monuments. Currency is named after them. So I realized that if I wanted to study leadership, I wanted it to be not just their leadership days in the White House, but asking the questions at the beginning, starting with when they first run for office. So I take Lincoln at 23 when he runs and loses, and take Teddy at 23 and Franklin at 28 and LBJ at 23, and they struggle and they have swelled heads and there's failure and they learn so that their struggles don't seem as different from our own. So a young person could feel, I can follow that path. I may not see myself at the pinnacle right away, but they started somewhere else at the beginning. And it was a really good way of going back to learning about them when they were young in terms of leadership. You know, I'd studied them in biographical forms before, but here I was asking, where did their ambition come from? When did they first recognize themselves as leaders? Are there leadership traits that they were born with, or did they develop them? And if so, how so? How did they get through adversity? All these questions we used to talk about when I was in college and grad school. Now suddenly we're on the top of my mind. So it was a big adventure.
Take Abraham Lincoln first. What do you think about his early life prepared him to even consider that he might become a leader?
It's a really interesting question. I think what happened is that even though he was only able to attend school a few months here and a few months there, he was considered by his other colleagues in the town in which he lived as the most learned boy among them all, because he had taught himself to read, he had taught himself to write. You know, he scoured the countryside for books and read everything he could lay his hands on. So when one of the students, for example, was trying to figure out the system of whether the sun goes around the earth or the earth goes around the sun, Abraham was the one who could explain it to her. He became the teacher. So I think early on he developed a certain confidence in the makings of his mind. And then he also had born, I think, one of the leadership qualities of empathy. There are stories of him, even when he's young, and other little kids in the neighborhood are putting hot coals on turtles to make them wriggle. And he says, that's wrong. Why should we revel in somebody else being hurt? Or another time, he and a group of friends are walking home, and there's a drunken man lying on the side of the road, and they all pass him by. And then Lincoln walks back to pick him up and bring him home. So there was qualities that you could see in him early on. And the people in his neighborhood began to push him forward. They helped him with books. They helped him have a fire at night so that he could read. And he goes to this place of New Salem. He's there for only 6 months and decides to run for office. He said, I'm hoping that I might be able to make a pact with you, that I will do whatever I can for you if you should elect me. But if you don't, I've been too familiar with disappointment to be very much chagrined. But then incredibly, what he adds to that is he said, but if I do lose, that won't be the end of it. I'll try 5 or 6 more times until it's absolutely humiliating, and then I won't try again if I lose.
You know what's so incredible is that the backgrounds of each of these men is so different from each of the others.
You know, that's the really interesting thing. I think sometimes people think there's a formula for leadership. And what you see here, it's absolutely true. Their paths to their leadership are different. Their backgrounds are starkly different. I mean, you think of Lincoln having to just make his way, little by little to even survive in those early years, and having only 11 months of full schooling, compared to Teddy Roosevelt, who, when he wants a book, all he has to do in his wealthy home is to pick a volume from the well-stocked shelves. Or if he mentions a book to his father, it will somehow magically appear. And then he gets to have 2 years of travel abroad with his father always as his tutor, just learning and adventuring. And when he runs for office the first time, it's not that he puts himself forward as Abraham Lincoln did, but the political boss comes to him and suggests that he might be a good candidate, because his father's name was pretty well known as a philanthropist, and they knew he had money that he could help with the campaign. So things were sort of handed to him in a way that never was true for Abraham Lincoln.
It's so interesting because you write that early on, each of these men faced what you describe as terrible tragedy and loss. Tell us about that.
Yes, you know, in the leadership literature, they talk about the fact that often leaders are those who've come through adversity and been able to, you know, somehow subtract wisdom and growth from that adversity. And in the case of these four, it was really bad adversity. I mean, I think most people might not have to go through such harrowing times to grow. But in Lyndon Johnson's case, back down to Abraham Lincoln's case, and the two Roosevelts, it's almost like tragedy befell all of them. In Lincoln's case, what happened is he had a near suicidal depression when he was in his 30s. And it came from a really interesting reason, because one of the core beliefs he had in himself was that he was a man who kept his word. And he had promised when he first ran for the state legislature that he would bring infrastructure projects to that section of Illinois so that poor farmers could bring their produce to market. So they dredged the rivers and make roads and harbors. And he got the projects all going, but then a terrible recession hit the state and the projects were half finished and the state went into debt. And Lincoln was blamed for that process. So he left the state legislature. And at the same time, he broke his word to Mary Todd when he broke his engagement to her. And that sense that he had broken his word to his constituencies and to Mary, and he knew it was humiliating Mary for his having done so, led to a depression so deep that his friends took all knives and razors and scissors from his room. And his best friend comes to his side and says, Lincoln, you must rally or you will die. And incredibly, he says, I am just ready to die right now. However, I've not yet done anything to make any human being remember that I have lived. That's incredible that even then he had this desire somehow to be remembered for having done something worthy, for having made a difference in people's lives. And that became his lodestar, and it carried him back to the state legislature, into the Congress, two Senate seats that were lost, and finally a dark horse candidate to the presidency. But he had grown through that experience.
And what about Teddy Roosevelt?
What happens to Teddy, I mean, he has such a privileged life up until the time when he hits Harvard and his beloved father dies of a sudden cancerous condition. But even that, he somehow is able to get through just because he says he knows he has an optimistic temperament. But then he falls in love and he marries a young woman and he's in the state legislature and she's delivering a child and he gets a telegram in Albany saying, "Your child, a daughter, is born," and they all celebrate with cigars. And then minutes later comes another telegram from his brother saying, "Your wife is dying and our mother is dying too. Come home immediately." And it turned out that his mother, who was only 49, had contracted typhoid fever, and he gets home in time to be with her when she dies at 3 a.m., and then he goes upstairs with Alice, his wife, who dies like 12 hours later. So it was a double death in that person's life, and it was so devastating to him that he left the East Coast and went out to the Badlands, where he had purchased a ranch, and he could ride his horse 15 hours a day, and somehow he said, constant motion kept him able to sleep at night. But it meant that he became then this person who loved the open spaces and reveled in being in other parts of America than the Eastern coast. So he became known to people as a Westerner, as well as an Easterner, which enormously increased his appeal to the country as a whole, which was split between the cities in the East and the Western rural areas. And he developed the great conservation measures that are permanently associated with his name. So, you know, that adversity really did change him in a lot of ways, too.
You learned so many new things about each of these men that you hadn't known before, even though you've been studying them, talking about them, lecturing about them for so many years.
That's what made it so much fun. I mean, I thought at first, oh, I know my guys, as I sometimes like to call them, because I feel so familiar with them, having studied them for 50 years. But when you take away all the stuff that surrounded the biographies, you know, their wives, their children, their friends, their colleagues, the situations they faced, and really look inside at their leadership skills and where they came from, I had to do more research than I thought I would have to do. And that's what made it fun. I'm glad it took 5 years. I mean, with FDR, for example, because I'd written about No Ordinary Time, meaning the 1940 to 1945 war years, I really had never studied the 100 days, which later became the case study in this book, nor really his experience with polio. He was already paralyzed when I did my book, and there might have been a page about the previous polio. But here, to just see what he went through after he was paralyzed, I mean, this was his trial by fire. It took 2 years, 3 years before he could even begin to resemble walking again. You know, when he first was diagnosed, he couldn't even get out of the wheelchair on his own. So he would ask people to lift him from the wheelchair and put him on the floor in a crawling position in his library. And he would crawl all around the room hour after hour just to strengthen his back and his arms. And then he started tackling stairs and he would hoist himself up the stairs one at a time, sweat pouring from him. And when he reached the top, though, this was his great temperament, they would have a great celebration. We did it. We made it to the top. There's a moment when somebody says to him, you know, how can you get through all the pressures of the presidency? He said, if you spent 2 years trying to move your big toe, anything would seem easy. But that experience he went through and then creating Warm Springs, which he made a rehabilitation center that was wonderful, not just for physically rehabbing polio victims, but rather making them find joy in life again. He would have wheelchair dances. He would have poker games. He would have songs, picnics, so that they could learn that life could be lived ordinarily again. And he called himself Doc Roosevelt. And I think that experience, as everybody said, meant that he emerged more warm-hearted than he had ever been before, more able to connect to other people to whom fate had also dealt an unkind hand. So he was the perfect person to be there when we have a economic paralysis in the country, for he had conquered his own physical paralysis.
What happened to LBJ, however, was different, a loss in political terms. What happened there?
Yeah, you know, in some ways, to make as an analog, the loss of LBJ's 1941 Senate race to these other experiences that the three others had to go through may seem crazy, except for LBJ, that loss was considered a repudiation of his deepest self. And he had gone into politics originally, you know, with a real desire to do things for people. He was a New Deal liberal, and he had run the National Youth Administration in Texas. He had brought electricity to his own hill country. He had taught Mexican-American students in Cotulla. And then once he lost this election, he realized that he had to make money. That's what he decided to do. I'm now going to make money because who knows if politics is going to work. And he also had to become more conservative to try and run the second time around when the next Senate seat opened up. So he did win that second time in 1948. But then he just concentrated, it seemed, on getting power, getting power and wealth. And he did become the majority leader of the Senate. But then he had a nearly fatal heart attack in 1955. And what happened is when he came out of that heart attack and a period of depression that followed it, he asked himself the question, what if I died now? What would I be remembered for? I mean, very similar to Abraham Lincoln. It's so interesting. And then he set out really then to return to the roots of that progressive politician he had been. He got the first civil rights bill through the Senate. And then, of course, when he went into the presidency, that extraordinary period of legislation of the civil rights bill, the voting rights bill, Medicare, Medicaid, education, NPR, PBS, everything, until Vietnam cut that legacy in two, he was being remembered for somebody as great as FDR.
Tell that story about LBJ that got you brought right in front of LBJ to his office and relegated to a small agency.
Well, what happened is I was chosen when I was 24 years old as a White House fellow, a fabulous program that still exists today. I mean, Colin Powell was a White House fellow, Wesley Clark. We had a big dance at the White House the night we were selected. President Johnson did dance with me, but it wasn't that peculiar. There were only three women out of the 16 White House fellows. But as he twirled me around the floor, he whispered that he wanted me to be assigned directly to him in the White House. But it was not to be that simple. For in the months leading up to my selection, like many young people, I was active in the anti-Vietnam War movement. And a friend of mine and I had written an article against LBJ, which we'd sent into the New Republic, hadn't heard anything. But 2 days after the dance in the White House, the article appeared with the title, How to Remove Lyndon Johnson from Power. I was certain he would kick me from the program. But instead, surprisingly, he said, oh, bring her down here for a year. And if I can't win her over, no one can. So I did not work for him originally. I was put into Secretary of Labor Willard Wirt's office, who I loved and adored. But then when Johnson resigned from the race that March of 68, he called Wirtz and he called me and he said, okay, you said I should get out of office. I've gotten out. Now you have to come and work for me. So I then transferred to the White House and then accompanied him to his ranch to help him on his memoirs, those last years of his life. The most formidable, interesting, incredible character I've ever met. And no question, that was the beginning of my becoming a presidential historian.
Doris, that is such a wonderful story. Let's talk about the Civil War and whether that is why we remember Abraham Lincoln as we do. What would have happened if there had been no Civil War? Would we think of Lincoln today as we do?
It's so interesting because Theodore Roosevelt posed the very same question you are. He said, if there's not a war, we wouldn't remember Lincoln today. There'd be no great general. There'd be no great statesman. He was sort of questioning that whole thing. Does the man make the times or the times make the man? That you need opportunity in order to do something great. But you also have to be ready when that moment of greatness comes. The interesting thing I think about Lincoln is that even if there'd been no civil war, even if he had not become president, the people who knew him in Illinois up till that time knew they were in the presence of somebody special. And they would have known that and they would have remembered him just for having been Abraham Lincoln. But of course, the platform that the breakup in the Democratic and Republican parties and the Whig Party going out and the Republican Party coming in, the fact that a gift for language was so important in those run-up years to the Civil War because the anti-slavery movement was really mobilizing itself, the fact that the Democratic Party was split in two, so he was able to win that election. Chance made it possible for him to be there, even though, you know, not that many people knew him that well outside of Illinois when he ran and won. But then once he got there, he proved to be the right man for that right time. I mean, he had the patience and the persistence and the mercifulness and the mercy and, you know, the ability to acknowledge his mistakes and the ability to create a team that really felt loyal to him. All the qualities of leadership seemed to be embedded in Abraham Lincoln. I always felt if I could know him, it wouldn't be just following him as a leader, but he'd make you a better person. He was the kind of person who would say, don't let envy or anger or jealousy fester or it'll poison a part of you. Not that he didn't feel those human emotions, which we all do, but he just knew that you just don't have time to let them become obsessive with you. So I always felt if I knew him, I'd be a better person, much less better historian writing about him.
You know, we talk about Democrats and Republicans back then. We look at Democrats and Republicans now. Has there ever been such a time of partisanship as bad as it is today, or has it always been that way?
I don't think it's always been that way. I think we've gone in cycles, but there's no question in the 1850s, it was a bad time. I mean, in those days, there weren't really national newspapers. So the way you got your news was by buying your subscription to your paper, to the Republican paper, say, or the Democratic paper. And in terms of alternate facts that we have today, I mean, there are stories told that if you're reading about a Stephen Douglas debate with Abraham Lincoln in the Republican newspaper, it might say, he was so great in the debate. People were clapping so loud that they carried him out on their shoulders in triumph. That same debate would be covered in the Democratic papers saying he was so terrible and fell so flat that he fell on the floor in humiliation and they had to drag him out of the place. So I'm afraid there is some forerunner to our situation today. Or similarly, I remember when Charles Sumner was hit over the head with a cane, a Massachusetts senator, by a Southern congressman named Brooks. And that was one thing that was bad enough. But the thing is that the South and the North treated it entirely different. In the South, Preston Brooks was considered a hero, and people walked around with canes all over the place, you know, wielding them in the streets. In the North, there were all sorts of marches and organizational drills against what had happened to Sumner, and it was really part of mobilizing that anti-slavery clause. So I think, you know, I think we had that time before, but we should take not much solace from that because it ended up in a civil war with 600,000 people dying. I think what's happened today really has no precedent in recent history. We've had the last couple presidents where there's not been any much happening to bipartisanship. That's true. But you didn't have a feeling that they saw each other, you know, as the other or as real tribal enemies as opposed to opponents in parties. And that's just grown in these years. I mean, and it's at a height right now. And I sometimes wonder whether it's because, you know, in the 50s and the 60s, a lot of the congressmen and senators had been in the World War II or the Korean War together. So they knew what it was like to have a common mission for the group of people. They felt a sense of belonging to the Congress or the House or the Senate that was more than just to themselves. They stayed in Washington on the weekends and played poker and drank together instead of running home to raise funds. We've made all the situations, I think, harder for our politicians to get together. Congressional districting, you know, makes it unnecessary to go toward the middle. So, but I keep thinking that, and that's what the book really gives me courage to think about. FDR used to say, problems created by man can be solved by man. So when I see what these four leaders were able to do, Lyndon Johnson getting that civil rights bill through that nobody thought could possibly get through, FDR getting the 100 days through and solving that banking crisis, you know, and TR having a square deal for the rich and the poor that took a lot of the animus out of the political dialogue then, and of course, Lincoln winning the Civil War and saving the Union and ending slavery, they did it, and it was much harder than what we have to do, and that's why we have to look to history as evidence that we can do it again. I think it's very reassuring, history can be.
You say that Teddy Roosevelt would be the leader who might be able to get us out of the quagmire we find ourselves in today. Why do you think he would be the one?
Well, I think it's in part because the situation he faced has similarities to the one we're facing today. When the Industrial Revolution came about, it really shook up the economy in the ways that the technological revolution and globalization have done today. For the first time, you had a gap between the rich and the poor. You had people feeling a way different from the people in the cities. The people in rural areas looked to the people in the cities as sinful characters. Lots of immigrants were coming in from abroad, and this gap had developed between the rich and the poor, so that there were a lot of inventions that made people feel things are moving too fast, telegraph, telephone, submarine. Maybe we want to go back to an earlier America. So I think that was a situation that candidate Trump was able to mobilize those people's feelings and make them feel that he was on their side. And Teddy Roosevelt had the charisma to be on the side of the people, but he wanted it to be not just one part of America. In fact, he said the rock of democracy would fail if people who lived in different regions and different sections thought of themselves as the other and didn't have a fellow feeling toward another. So when he came in, right away he talks about a square deal for the capitalist and the wage worker, the rich and the poor, moderate rational reform to deal with some of the worst aspects of the industrial order, but not choke off the business community. And he starts to save all that land for conservation. But most importantly, he was charismatic. He could fight. He would fit in. He'd be great in the Twitter world. He had all those little punchy statements, you know, speak softly and carry a big stick. You know, what, don't hit until you have to, but then hit hard. He even gave Maxwell House the slogan, good to the very last drop. So he would have been just fine. He had such a quick mind in the Twitter world. But he would have been fighting on the side of a unified nation, not on the side of one faction in that nation, which is what's happening today.
At the same time, you also point out his governmental experience, which would have allowed him to know exactly the balance that he had to create within government.
Absolutely right. I mean, you know, one of the things that's sad about the 2016 election was that it seemed like political experience was a liability, that anyone who had political experience was thrown out by the primary voters in favor of a person in Mr. Trump who had had the least experience, not even in politics, but even as a leader. I mean, it's one thing to be a leader of a big business, and you've learned how to run a team, you've learned how to shareholders have to be satisfied, constituents, your own team. But he had come in really as his own person. And in contrast, Teddy Roosevelt had been a state legislator, and then he had gone out to the Badlands and been a cowboy, and he came back to the Civil Service Commission. Then he was police commissioner in New York. And those experiences, he later said, they broadened his own sense of empathy, that from his privileged background at first, he felt a little strange walking into the slums and going into the tenements. But after a while, he realized this was part of his learning experience to be a good public leader. And he became much more empathetic than he had been before. And then, of course, he's a soldier in the Army. And then he becomes governor and vice president. He's assistant secretary of the Navy. And all of this before he's the youngest president in the history of the country. But that kind of experience at federal, state, local level, it's all city levels, I think really made him right ready as soon as he got into that office.
With all these experiences, it's clear, as you write, that leadership does not exist in a void. It takes the public, it takes what's happening in the world to actually forge leadership in that person.
No question. I mean, Abraham Lincoln, when he was being praised after the Emancipation Proclamation and the beginnings of the end of the war as the great liberator, he said, no, it's the anti-slavery people that did it all. And he's right. Without the anti-slavery movement that began to get more and more powerful in the 1850s, that finally did create the new Republican Party, you know, that kept the fire on people to, we have to do something about ending slavery, he would not have had the foundation to do what he did. Without the progressive movement, which had already begun to develop at the turn of the 20th century in the churches, in the settlement houses, in the cities, Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt would not have been able to do what they did. And surely without the civil rights movement, Lyndon Johnson would not have been able to get that civil rights bill through. It was a partnership between the civil rights movement and the president. And that's the moment when Johnson, in his famous voting rights speech, used the phrase, "We shall overcome." It was almost a symbolic sense of, that's your song, but now we're making it our song, and I'm going to work inside to get this bill through. You've done the work on the outside. So I think even now when we look at our situation and we're trying to figure out who our next leaders might be, I mean, the one encouraging thing is that a lot of new people are entering public life, record-breaking numbers of women coming into public life. There's a lot of activism on the part of the citizenry. And all through our history, whether it's the women's movement or the environmental movement or the gay rights movement, that activism is essential to getting change done. So we need to look at ourselves, I think, as well as our leaders. And that's part of the lesson, I think, in this book.
Do you think that what's happening now, historians will look back on and see as kind of a blip in our history, or are we going even farther and farther down a path of separation?
Well, I surely hope that it's more considered a blip rather than a path of separation. But what it's going to take, I think, are our leaders that understand how deep these divisions are right now and know how to speak to different sides of people's feelings around the country. I mean, that's what Lincoln did so well. I mean, even during the 1850s, you know, he would say, you know, if the South no longer had slavery, they would not introduce it. If we in the North still had slavery, we wouldn't know how to get rid of it so quickly. I empathize with them, in other words, he's saying. And I think that's what you need now is a leader who goes around the country, goes to all the places. Like one thing Teddy Roosevelt did on his train trips, whistle-stop tours, he would go to states that he lost as well as states that he won. He wasn't just stoking his own base, and always talked about the common citizenry as the thing that had to be developed. And obviously that's what Lincoln talked about. They all did. I mean, I think they all made you feel a sense of what it was to be an American and what it was we had in common. It's much harder now with the technology, you know, with the internet, with the social media, with cable news. When you had three television networks for JFK and Ronald Reagan, and you had more national radio before that for FDR and national newspapers at the time of Teddy Roosevelt, you could get the bully pulpit working from the White House. And now it's just yet another voice, I think, among thousands of other voices that are speaking out. And it's hard to know who's got the voice of authority.
So who do you think this book might reach in a way that really makes sense in their hearts, Doris?
Well, what I'm really hoping is that we have to imagine a different future for us right now in order to begin to work toward it. Because I just worry that sometimes we're accepting the norms of this constant daily agitation, the next thing that's dropping as far as what Mr. Trump or the people around him have done. And it's almost like being caught up in this web. And we have to begin to think, what are we going to do? How are we going to get out of this? It's not even a matter of just saying that maybe Trump will be impeached or maybe not. The political system created this situation, and it needs a lot of revolution. The political system does. And that's the way it will be a blip rather than going down the path. But it's going to take a lot of self-recognition on the part of the people in power and the people that are coming into power, and maybe the new people, that things have to be different. It's been bad for a while. I mean, it's been bad. No major bipartisan legislation getting through for these last years. You know, if one party wants it, then the other party doesn't. And it's no fun to be in Washington in those circumstances. So the one encouraging thing, I think, is that, you know, since the inauguration, there has been a rise in activism. There are young people now and different people, teachers, doctors entering public life. And I think we have to just make it robust again. So I'm hoping the book on that level reaches those people, hoping it's reaching young leaders too, that can learn from the paths that these people followed, the difficulties they went through and the resilience that they showed. But I think even for us in our daily lives, I mean, I talk in here about how they fell asleep at night when things were tough, how they controlled negative emotions. And those are all things that we can do ourselves so that, you know, the kind of qualities of resilience and empathy and humility and acknowledging errors are things that just make us better people in our families or our communities. So there's something underlying leadership that is really human nature. And that's why I think it has a wide application.
Doris, congratulations on this book. I hope millions of people read it.
Thank you so much. Me too. It would be great.
historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her latest book is titled Leadership in Turbulent Times. That's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Douglas Bell and Josephine Nayunai. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Marie.